The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, it's Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide here. Welcome to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. This is just a note to say that if you are hearing this, then you are not currently part of my membership programme and will only be hearing the first part of each show. In order to access full episodes of the Tudor History and Travel Show, you will need to become a member of my membership site, The Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England, via the link in the description associated with this podcast. Well, we are fast in the run-up to the festive season, of course, so this makes this episode the final episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show for this year, 2024. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is a wrap, as they say. I hope you've enjoyed all the episodes that we have sent your way over the course of the last 3 months. It's always a delight to hear from our listeners. So if there's a particular episode that you've really loved this year, why not drop me a line and tell me about it at sarah@thetudortravelguide.com. There are not too many notices in this episode, but I just want to remind you that as we head into 2025, I've of course been making plans for next year's podcasts, which are well underway now for the entire year. And of course, there's going to be a whole new stream of content on the blog. So that reminds me to remind you that if you're not subscribed to the Tudor Travel Guide blog, but want to get your fix of some detailed Tudor content, of course, being the Tudor Travel Guide, we have a focus on the places and we tell the stories of people and events of the Tudor period through the lens of those historic places that are left behind. And so if you're not yet subscribed to my mailing list and want to be among the first to hear about new blogs or new podcasts that are going live or indeed events that are taking place, then do make sure that you are subscribed to my blog at www.thetudortravelguide.com. And of course, I mention events there as ever over on our sister site, Simply Tudor Tours. Well, that's the place to go if you're looking to do an in-person tour with me and indeed a plethora of other special guests that we bring along to our detailed in-person tours. And of course, next year we have two. One is already full, Anne and Elizabeth, Mother, Daughter, Traitors, Queens. That's running in May. That we are already fully booked there. But there are still places on the rise and fall of Anne Boleyn, which will take place in September. So you can subscribe to our mailing list, our VIP list there, and be among the first to hear about new tours by going over to the homepage of www.simplytudortours.com. All right, well, I think that's all I need to say. Now, today I am heading actually just up the road from where I'm recording this today to Warwick, the county town of Warwickshire. Now, perhaps Warwick is most well known for its castle, and a very splendid castle it is. However, for me, the jewel of Warwick is undoubtedly the Beauchamp Chapel in St Mary's Parish Church in the centre of Warwick town. Now, if you've followed the Tudor Travel Guide for a while, you know it's not my first visit to the Beauchamp Chapel, and I've certainly talked about it quite a lot on our Instagram lives and done some features on the tombs in the chapel for my membership. But on this occasion, I got the opportunity to visit again and team up once more with the church historian there, Tim Clark, who generously shared his time as our expert guide. Now, Tim has just written a book about the Beauchamp Chapel. It's beautifully illustrated, well worth getting a copy for. And in fact, you will find details of where you can get a copy, and you can order them wherever you are in the world. You'll find those details in our show notes page. As ever, we have a show notes page, which includes an extract from Tim's book alongside some images of the chapel that you might want to refer to as you listen to this podcast. There will also be links in there which will point you towards where you need to go if you want to order a copy of the book for yourself. Now, as you will hear in this podcast, the Beauchamp Chapel is a very, very special place. And it was a place, actually, I only first became acquainted with just 2 or 3 years ago now. How it escaped me for this long, I do not know. But the combination of its utterly exquisite architecture and some of the most splendid tombs you'll see, and not only that, from a Tudor perspective, of course, it contains the tombs of Robert and Lettice Dudley and Robert's brother Ambrose and his infant son, who of course died young, Robert, the noble imp. And so really important from a Tudor history lover's perspective as well. Well, that combination is utterly irresistible, and I'm not going to withhold its delights from you any longer, because what we're going to do now is we're going to do a little bit of time travelling. So as ever, buckle up, my friends. Let's go straight over to St Mary's Church in Warwick and visit the Beauchamp Chapel with our guide, Tim Clark. So welcome, dear listeners. In fact, it's welcome back, because I am returning to a place that I first was introduced to a couple of years ago now and utterly fell in love with. I'm actually sitting in the Beauchamp Chapel at St Mary's in Warwick, and in a moment I'll be introducing you to our expert guide for the day, who's going to be talking to us about one of the great families of Warwick, of course, the Dudleys, and the brothers Robert and Ambrose are both buried here in the chapel. We'll be hearing about the history of medieval and Tudor Warwick in particular, as well as particularly focusing on the history of the Beauchamp Chapel, its founders, and of course this question as to why the Dudleys chose to be buried here. Now, the person who's going to help us navigate all this is our expert for today, Tim. Hello, Tim Clark.
Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the Beauchamp Chapel.
Yes, I feel like this is almost round three, isn't it? In one format or another.
Yes, but it's we have the 550th anniversary of the Beauchamp Chapel coming up in 2025, so next year. You know, it's a wonderful opportunity to showcase the chapel, and thank you for that. But also, I think, as we'll explore later, to give perhaps a slightly different dimension to the Dudleys as part of their history that isn't perhaps as well known as other areas.
I'm looking forward to it. And I'd like to say at the top of this podcast that you had recently published a book on the Beauchamp Chapel, so there's no finer guide.
Thank you. Yes, again, that's part of our anniversary celebrations. And it's something we're quite proud of. I mean, it's very, I think the industry term is image-led. And the one thing about the Beauchamp Chapel that is undeniable is that it's extremely photogenic.
It certainly is. I remember the first time I walked through those double doors, because you enter these double doors. I don't know what I was expecting. I'd heard a number of people eulogise about it, and I thought, well, it can't be that great. It's just a parish church, after all. And I remember walking through the doors just going, wow. It absolutely blew my socks off. It's exquisite. And I would say, you know, next to the Lady Chapel in Westminster, I think it's one of my favourite Lady Chapels in the country.
Yes, I wish I had a pound for every visitor I've heard stand at those steps and go, wow. I mean, it is the most common reaction. It is, as you say, a Lady Chapel dedicated to the Virgin Mary. I think there is one big difference between ourselves and the Henry VII Chapel at Westminster Abbey. And that is, of course, the Henry VII Chapel is absolutely magnificent with its fan-vaulted ceiling. It has its wonderful effigies of Henry VII and Elizabeth of York. And you know, I'm not going to claim in any sense that we're better than that. But we are different in the sense that here, the entire chapel was planned holistically. So the chapel tells a story. And that you don't get. I don't think you get that anywhere else that I can think of, certainly not in England.
So we're going to come back and tell the story of this chapel, as well as go and look at some of its tombs, because there are four really magnificent and interesting tombs in here, and we'll talk about each of those in turn. But before then, I thought it would be useful just to sort of zoom out and set the scene a little bit by looking at medieval, because obviously this chapel was founded during the medieval period, medieval and Tudor Warwick. And who were the great landowners? Because we have these two families that come up when you come here, the Beechams and the Dudleys. Talk to us about how the history of Warwick developed over that period.
Sure. Warwick dates itself from 914. There was, of course, a settlement here before that, but it really starts in 914 when Ethelfrida, Lady of the Mercians, and of course daughter of Alfred the Great, founded a defensive position here against the threat of the Vikings, one of a chain that she did across the, what we would now consider the border between the West and East Midlands, and indeed further south. And Warwick has a natural promontory above the river crossing, so it's a natural place to put a castle. And then you fast forward 150 years to the Norman conquest, and with William the Conqueror wishing to exert Norman authority over the country, identifies Warwick as a natural place for a castle. And he creates the Earldom of Warwick very early, 1068, so only 2 years after the conquest. And it's the connection between the town, the earldom, and shortly afterwards St. Mary's, that really colours the history of the town for the next 400 years.
I'm just glad you mentioned the castle, because I know a lot of people listening to this will think of Warwick and they'll think of the castle. And that's how I used to think of Warwick. And that's probably the main centre of attraction. And I think that's why for many years I didn't actually come here, because I didn't really realise what's just a stone's throw away. And part of me talking so much about St Mary's and the Beecham Chapel is to make sure that people definitely do both. And in fact, there's also the Lord Leicester as well. So you've got a real group of fantastic historic buildings here, haven't you?
Yes, and I think the history of the castle and St Mary's, as I said, is intertwined for centuries. So St Mary's as a church was founded, we don't know when. There are no records, there's no archaeological evidence of the original church. But what evidence there is would suggest probably around 960, 970, but in truth, we don't really know. But at that time, the main church in Warwick was called All Saints, and that was a minster church.
Ah.
In other words, it was of local importance and was a mother church for several churches around it. And that was an early Anglo-Saxon foundation. The problem was its location, because it was right next to what was to become the castle.
Oh, I see.
So when the castle was expanded by the Normans from sort of 1068 onwards, All Saints found itself enveloped inside the castle walls, which isn't great for your main parish church,
indeed,
for anybody. And so All Saints fell into disuse as a parish church and in effect became the private chapel for the earls and their household in the castle. And it's long gone. I mean, again, no trace of it survives. But to get over this problem, the Earls of Warwick began to patronise the second church in Warwick, which was St Mary's here.
Right.
And in 1123, Roger de Newburgh, the second Earl of Warwick, granted his charter for a college of priests here. So he became the Collegiate Church of St Mary, and that's how we're still known.
So the de Newburghs were the founders.
Yes. But
so where did the Beecham family come in? Talk to us about that.
Well, the de Newburghs die out. The male line dies out, which is probably just as well, because they're pretty useless. And after the initial foundation, they more or less neglect St Mary's. Most of their time is taken up with litigation with dowager countesses, who were a remarkably long-lived and litigious lot.
Okay.
I think at one time there were three dowager countesses alive.
Seriously?
And of course, I mean, that has a devastating effect on the income of the Earl, because he's got to fund, you know, the dowagers who
happy
had
families,
great great expectations of their appropriate lifestyle. So the Newburghs probably just as well disappear. And due to a very fortuitous series of early deaths and childless marriages, the heirs to the earldom become the Beechams. And this is in 1268. Now, the Beechams' power base is Worcestershire. Their main residence is Elmley Castle, which is now in ruins. There are still traces of it left. That's sort of Redditch Evesham way.
Right.
And that's where they were based. And they inherit the earldom in 1268, as I said. They don't come to Warwick immediately. And it's not really until Guy of Warwick, Earl Guy, who, of course, is famous for having Piers Gaveston executed.
Right, OK, thank you for making
just
that
outside,
link.
Just outside the town here, his main claim to fame.
Is that where it happened? Right.
Yeah, the Blacklow Hill, which is 3 miles out of Warwick. Okay. Just an aside, nothing to do with St Mary's, but Gaveston was tried, and I use the word cautiously,
loosely,
at Warwick Castle. He was then deliberately taken out of the town and out of the lands of the Earls of Warwick and executed on his neighbour's land, who was the Earl of Lancaster, and therefore making sure the Earl of Lancaster was well and truly tied up with all of this.
That's one way to do
but
it.
But that is an aside.
Yeah.
But it's Guy who starts the movement of the Beechams to Warwick. He dies leaving an infant son, Thomas, and this is in 1315. Thomas is probably about 18 months, 2 years old. We don't know exactly when he was born. Thomas is brought up by a man whose name will be familiar to many of our listeners, the infamous Roger Mortimer.
Of
Wigmore. not necessarily the greatest role model, though it's fair to say his notoriety postdates all of this. And as was normally the case, the idea of becoming someone's guardian, which of course you paid handsomely for, was to marry your daughter off to your ward. And that duly happened, we think probably around 1327, probably at Hereford Cathedral, when Thomas Beecham married Catherine Mortimer. And it was a very long and successful marriage. Thomas grows up to be one of Edward III's greatest and most respected military commanders. He's very close to Edward. They're about the same age. They've both suffered at the hands of Roger Mortimer. This isn't the place to go into the relationship between Roger Mortimer and Edward III. Mm-hmm. Suffice it to say that the fact that Roger Mortimer had been Thomas's guardian doesn't seem to have done Thomas any harm at all. I suspect Edward had a lot of sympathy
right.
for him.
Yeah,
okay. And they clearly get on very well. Thomas makes his name in the Hundred Years' War at Crecy and Poitiers in particular, sieges of Calais. And he becomes one of the founder members of the Order of the Garter in 1348. You know, this great personal award recognising chivalry and loyalty to the crown. In fact, Thomas is member number 4. So if you go to St. George's Chapel, Windsor, unfortunately, his stall plate has been lost. But if you check their records there he is at number 4. So he is really, you know, right at the top of his game.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, brings him wealth and prestige. And he spends that lavishly. Firstly, he starts to rebuild Warwick Castle. And the Warwick Castle that we see today, certainly the great east front, which is what you see on all the photographs with its great gatehouse and twin towers, that's the work of Thomas and his son, also Thomas. They have to be a little bit careful because Edward III is rebuilding Windsor at the same time, so they can't outdo that. Nonetheless, they do produce a building which I think arguably is the finest castle in England, other than Windsor.
Yeah.
Others may argue about that, but I mean, there's no doubt it's absolutely magnificent. And this all, of course, is to highlight the prestige and the wealth and the authority of the Beechams. Thomas, unfortunately, dies before that work is completed. But his son, also Thomas, takes over, and so the project is completed. And the great twin towers at Warwick Castle, the latest of them probably dates from the 1390s.
Right.
Now, what's remarkable is that at the same time, they're also rebuilding St. Mary's. And incidentally, they're also rebuilding the chapel at what is now the Lord Leicester.
Oh, I see.
And so there were these magnificent building projects going on in Warwick at the same time. I mean, the place must have been absolutely teeming with masons and labourers. One can't really imagine what people living in Warwick were making of all of this at the time. But St. Mary's is rebuilt, and like the castle, it has to reflect the prestige of the Beechams. And there's an added dimension to this because Thomas Beecham and Catherine want to be buried here in the chancel. And indeed they are. And that's extremely unusual for persons of their rank to be buried in their local church. Normally, they would choose to be in a monastery or priory. That was the favoured destination for your body.
And I presume Warwick had a priory or a monastery.
Warwick did have a priory. It had two. It had a priory that was actually also founded by Roger de Newburgh, just before he founded the college here. The problem with that is that nobody liked them. the relationship between the prior and St. Mary's was problematic. And the relationship between the castle and the priory was problematic. In fact, again, another little aside, but in 1397, I think it was, the prior was a sort of ex officio member of the college here, part of the deal that had been done. And he was just completely making a nuisance of himself, basically by not paying money that the priory should have paid to St. Mary's. Don't worry about how that obligation arose, but he just didn't pay up. And in the end, we got fed up, and the prior gets summoned to the castle and given an absolute dressing down and basically sacked from the college at St. Mary's. Now, what is interesting is that that dressing down was not administered by the Earl. It was administered by the Countess.
Oh, really? Formidable.
Which is a little... Well, it also it is formidable, but it's also a little insight into something that is very easy to overlook, and that was the influence of women at this time.
Yeah.
There's a story about Catherine as well, which I'm not going to go into, but, but there's also evidence that she was very heavily involved in how Warwick was run at this time.
So you've just mentioned that Thomas is buried here alongside his wife in the chancel, and I know it's a lovely tomb with some very interesting features, and I'd love to go and have a look at that and discuss some of them with you and get your thoughts. So maybe we could just go over and do that now before we continue with the story of the Beauchamp Chapel.
Of course.
Tim, so we've come into the chancel. We're right in front of the high altar. There's another fairly splendid tomb here. Can you just tell us what we're looking at?
So we're looking at the tomb of Thomas Beauchamp and his wife, Catherine Mortimer, double tomb. And they're there before the high altar in the chancel that they built. Although, say, the work was actually completed by their son. Certainly they planned it. The effigies themselves largely are standard products. We're not in the era of portraiture here. So if you wanted the effigy of a knight or an earl, you just went to the workshop and they'd let you choose one from the pattern book, as it were. Quite as crude as that, but you get the idea.
Yeah, I do.
But what does distinguish this tomb is the fact that Thomas and Catherine are holding hands.
Ah, yes.
Which is really unusual. So to put that in context, there's about 20 tombs in Europe before the Reformation where the husband and wife are holding hands together.
Is it that few? I didn't realise.
Yeah, there's a few more brasses as well that you see it, but they were about that. So all in all, I think 40 have been accounted for in Europe, and actually three of them were here, although we've lost two. And there were brasses which we lost in the fire. But clearly those two were an imitation of this. And various theories are put as to why they're holding hands. But I think here the explanation is quite clearly that they are in love, and it's a partnership. When you look at them, there's almost a look of apprehension to them. They're not staring into each other's eyes with sort of gooey expressions. I think they're embarking on the journey to the next life together.
Right.
And what I think is interesting is that this is sort of indicative of what is the inspiration for the Beecham Chapel. Because not only do we have Thomas and Catherine here in a space that is very personal to them, but there's also an argument that the very architecture of the chancel reflects elements of Thomas's life. Now, that's quite a statement to make, and I'm not going to go into much detail on that. But it does highlight the fact that it is their space.
Mm.
And I think that the fact that their son Thomas and Richard Beecham were not buried in the chancel as well emphasises that theory of personal space.
Mm.
And then just finally, on this tomb around, we have an incredible number. I think it's 36, lose count.
That is a lot.
Figures around the tomb. Now, we'll be talking later in the Beecham Chapel about weepers.
Mm.
But we have these characters here. Now, we don't know who they are. All I think we need to say now is that they are an incredible display of late 14th century costume. And we have in the past had people come here specifically to study
just the costume
just by looking at this. Yeah.
I mean, you could spend ages, there's just so much detail to pore over.
Exactly.
It's a lovely tomb. I mean, exactly. It's not really necessarily the focus of what we're talking about today, but it's such a delightful find because it's just such a glorious tomb. And I love the fact we've had a chance to talk about the holding hands thing because I know there are different theories, but I'm with you. I think overall it's got to be an expression of love, I think.
Yes, and I think this partnership element as well is important. But I think probably you can't generalise and say the same theory fits all the hand-holding tombs. But here I think it's very definitely we're in this together.
Okay, well, I think with that we can head back into the Beecham Chapel and pick up our story.
Let's go.
We're going back into the Beecham Chapel now to pick up the story. And I know of the four tombs that I mentioned at the top of this podcast, there's one of them who is a Beecham. Richard Beecham, Earl of Warwick, as I can helpfully see on the sign in front of me, 1382 to 1439. First of all, what relation is he to Thomas, the tomb that we've just been looking at? And secondly, I know he's the founder of this chapel. How did that come about and why? Why didn't he just get buried in the chancel with his relative?
Richard is Thomas Beecham's grandson. So we mentioned earlier when we were talking about the castle, there was Thomas Beecham and his son, also Thomas, who finished the work. And it was his son who finished the chancel here as well. Unfortunately, we had a disastrous fire in 1694, which destroyed the nave and the transepts of the church. And with it, we lost Thomas Beecham II's tomb. Thankfully, we have a drawing of it, and we still have the brass from it. And usually they had an inscribed brass memorial on a canopied tomb rather than effigies. And that brass does survive. It's in very poor condition, but we do have it. And then his son is Richard Beecham, who we see before us here.
It is the most spectacular tomb, but before we get into it, I know I asked you about how is he here? So
why is he here?
Yeah, why is he in this particular chapel?
That's a very good question, and I think there are two reasons, really, though they're actually connected. Mm-hmm. One is that the chancel seems to have been very much intended to be reserved for Thomas and Catherine. It's very much personal space to them that was not to be invaded by other members of the family, and they respected that. So, as I say, Thomas Beecham II isn't buried in the chancel, and Richard is here. And I think the idea was that they had their own space dedicated to them. The other reason, I suspect, is that Richard wanted something much grander than a simple tomb in the chancel. So in 1437, he made his will, and in it, he directed that there be built at St. Mary's a new chapel dedicated to the Virgin Mary, in which his tomb would be situated. Now, although that will dates from 1437, undoubtedly the chapel had been planned for years before that. And his executors were men he knew closely and trusted. They were members of his household, and they're from families who had served his father and his grandfather before him. So there's this long established connection between families in Warwick who had given long and loyal service to the earls, who Richard could trust to implement his wishes.
And given the nature and the beauty and the scale and the exquisite workmanship of the chapel and his tomb, which I want to describe in some detail in a minute, well, for you to describe, Tim, you're probably much better at describing it. He also was very close to the crown and was in royal favour to garner the same kind of wealth and prestige and status to allow him to build this.
Indeed, he was very close to Henry V. So his grandfather had this close relationship with Edward III. And in Richard's case, it was Henry, not so much Henry IV, although he served under Henry IV. It was Henry IV who created him a member of the Order of the Garter at the tender age of 21.
Right.
But it was really Henry V who he was closer to in age, clearly kindred spirits. And then when Henry V died, of course, he left the young Henry VI, who was, 8 months old, when his father died. And in due course, Richard Beecham becomes Henry VI's tutor.
Oh, right.
And as such, he's responsible for his education and his upbringing. There is a suggestion that Henry VI wasn't necessarily a model pupil, but we needn't go into that too much. I think Richard was getting a bit exasperated at times. But he's also responsible for Henry VI's security. In his capacity as a keeper of Calais and later at Rouen. And so, for example, at Henry VI's coronation at Notre Dame, Henry VI, of course, being the only English king to have been crowned King of France in France at Notre Dame in 1431, Richard is there basically making sure he comes to no harm. He's in charge of right. the security on that day, okay. which must have been quite a tense
yes, you can imagine.
occasion.
Yes.
And Richard's other claim to fame from his time at Rouen is, of course, he was there when Joan of Arc was executed, burned at the stake for heresy, and that was on his watch.
Quite a life, quite a life. I remember, and actually what I'll say first, dear listeners, before I go one moment further, is that we're about to talk in some detail about the tomb, which I think is in my top three tombs in the UK. There's a countdown of my favourite tombs. Everybody who knows me and follows me will know I'm a taphophile. I love my tombs. So anyway, this is right up there. I want to just linger over it and savour it a little bit. But I just want to remind you all that, of course, we do have a show notes page that accompanies this podcast. So there will be lots of images on that show notes page to demonstrate exactly what it is that we're looking at. Right. I'm just going to savour this. And I'm going to, in some layman's terms, try and describe what I see. And then Tim's going to talk in proper grown-up language about what we're actually looking at. It's this beautiful, I guess it must be marble tomb, Chesterton.
Purbeck marble from Corfe in Dorset.
Well, we were just there the other day. So I've stood on Purbeck marble land. So, but it's the brass, isn't it? You've got this fantastic full-size brass effigy of Richard in his armour with, is it a phoenix at his feet? Is that what we have? A phoenix and a bear?
Griffin.
A griffin and a bear.
Which is the Despenser emblem. So Isabel Despenser was his second wife.
Right. And then we've got a really unusual, but I think it was quite common in the medieval period for high-status tombs, but there's not many left of this cradle, the brass cradle that goes over the top. What do you call that?
It's a hearse.
It's a hearse, right.
So, originally, a hearse meant a frame over a grave. And you do sometimes still see them, not original, but you still see them. For example, there's one at Winchester Cathedral over the grave of St Swithin.
Yes, yes.
So you've got a bit, could be quite a crude, simple wooden frame with a pall cloth over it. And that was very common.
And was that its purpose, basically, to drape a cloth across?
Yes, yes.
Why?
It was a sort of memorial, and it's something that you would do for a certain period of time after the burial.
I see.
And then perhaps on the anniversaries of the death.
I see.
You would do it. So it was a commemoration.
I see. That makes lots of sense.
Yeah.
Yes, because you've got this fantastic figure. I'm thinking, why would you want to cover that up with a pall cloth?
Well, we have to move the story on a bit, sort of the meaning of the word hearse, because it also comes to mean the frame that they put on a wagon when a body was being transported. So you've still got this idea of the frame being over a body, but now it's on a wagon, not over the grave itself. And it's from that that hearse came to mean the vehicle and not just the frame.
Yeah.
Now, its significance here is that it is part of the narrative of this chapel. We mentioned earlier the distinction between here and the Henry VII chapel at Westminster Abbey. Is that this was planned to tell a story. In fact, it tells three different stories. And one of them is Richard's journey back from Rouen, or more accurately, his body's journey back from Rouen. And so that frame, the hearse, is symbolising that journey.
I see.
And it is, in fact, unique.
Yeah.
Because it is an integral part of the tomb, rather than just a temporary structure that you put over it. And it's part of this narrative. And that narrative is continued in the inscription.
Mm.
It's unusually long. As you can see, it goes around the chest twice. And it starts, as you'd expect, with a request for prayers for the soul, like they all did.
Mm-hmm.
But then it very rapidly tells this story of the journey of the body from Rouen to Warwick, and basically what a pain it was for the executives to have to organise all of this. With that, how it comes over, I'm sure that's not what they intended. But it's clearly, from our point of view, it makes it very clear that journey is a central theme of the imagery of this tomb. So we've got the inscription, we've got the hearse over the effigy, the hearse that would have gone over the wagon, over the body that is brought back. And the third element of this are the weepers.
Can you just, before you go on, explain what a weeper is, if somebody's never heard that term before?
Weepers aren't weepers, generally. That's the first thing. We use the term to define people who are depicted on a tomb, but who are not the deceased.
Right.
Broadly speaking. And they're quite common on medieval tombs at the end of the 14th century. They're quite popular. So we've already seen them on the tomb of Thomas and Catherine in the chancel. And they're fairly typical of the sort of thing you'd expect around that time. But they're not weeping. Whatever else they're doing, they're not weeping. But around about 1400, they go out of fashion. And rather than get figures of individuals, if you have anything where they would be, they tend to be angels holding shields. That becomes the trend.
Right.
But then with this tomb, this is almost an outlier in chronological terms. We've gone back to these figures. And here they are generally weepers because they are in mourning. And in fact, the reason why we call these figures weepers on this tomb and previously is because that was the term that was used in the contract for this tomb. And then it's applied retrospectively to others. And what we have are 14 figures, 7 men, 7 women, all married couples. We've got 5 men down one side, the south side.
Mm.
Their wives are in the corresponding position on the north side, and then we have a married couple at each end. Like the effigy, they're in brass or latten. Like the effigy, they're being covered in gold.
Mm.
And between each of them, you have these angels, again in brass, and again, originally gilt.
Mm. And I guess you can tell who's who because of there are shields, heraldic shields, under each one of them.
Thankfully, unlike in the chancel on Thomas and Catherine's tomb, we do know who these people are. And there'll be some familiar names here. This one is Talbot, Earl of Shrewsbury. This is the Earl of Salisbury, Richard Neville, and of course, Richard Neville's son, Warwick the Kingmaker.
Very famous.
Another Richard Neville, very famous here. Mm. And he is married to Anne Beecham, who, of course, is in the corresponding position.
And Anne is whom in relation to the deceased?
Anne is one of Richard Beecham's daughters.
Right.
And we'll have to talk a bit more about her later.
Mm-hmm.
So Warwick the Kingmaker is Richard Beecham's son-in-law. And by the time this tomb is made, he is Earl of Warwick. But he's only Earl of Warwick by virtue of his marriage. The Warwick earldom could pass to females if there was no male heir.
Right.
And Anne becomes Countess of Warwick in 1449. And then, of course, her husband becomes Earl. So that's him there looking suitably grim and in mourning.
But the ladies on the other side look, they're dressed very differently. These look like, almost look like they're in monk's clothes. I mean, they're obviously a special type of mourning habit.
They are very monkish. And one of the reasons they're called weepers is because when we wrote the contract for the making of them, the term was translated directly from the French, plural. And in France and Burgundy, you very much had this tradition of such figures being monks or clergy, sometimes laymen, but in mourning. And the art of the tomb, and indeed much of the chapel, is heavily influenced by France and Burgundy, Burgundy in particular.
Because of Richard's time in France and...
Possibly, but also I think because this is something that we're doing some work on at the moment, but the interchange...
The cultural interchange.
Of course, there's a great trading tradition with Ghent.
And the Burgundian court.
Burgundian court, Utrecht, Brussels, cities like that, Antwerp. And there's that cultural exchange as well. Mm. There's a lot of men from the Low Countries working and settling in London at the time. In fact, we've got an example here, which we'll come to in a minute. So the men, although they look as though they're in monkish habits, are in fact in parliamentary robes, formal state robes. And we know that because on their shoulders, they've all got this exposed tippet, which is a piece of scarlet cloth with bands of miniver fur, squirrel. And that signifies that they're all ranks of earls.
Right, yes.
Some of them aren't. Some of them are actually dukes by now, but they can't outrank Richard.
Ah, I see.
So they're all shown as earls. And they're all the weepers, men and women, are carrying items of devotion. So they're either Book of Hours, prayer rolls, rosaries, that sort of thing.
Yes, I can see some rosaries. These are rosaries here.
There's like rosary the there, different of type beads. Of rosaries, yes. It looks like a girdle, but it's not. It's actually a rosary.
Yes.
And then the women, as you mentioned, on the other side, they're dressed up to the nines. They are in their absolute finest court fashion. They've all got very elaborate headdresses. Again, in the Burgundian style. And they've all got their dresses. They've all got deep V bodices with modesty panels. And that, again, is Burgundian and very high fashion. So although they're in mourning, They're in their glad rags, in that sense, yes. So, I mean, you can treat that, I suppose, as a sign of respect for the body, for the deceased coming back, or it's simply showing off.
Yeah, and I love tombs for that because they're one of the sources, aren't they, of what fashions were actually like at the time.
Very much so, but we have there's nothing else like this in England. As I said, first of all, they're beginning to gather fashion anyway. But nowhere else do you get this very continental influence on the sculpture.
Now, I was reading a paper about this after the first visit here because I wanted to know more about this spectacular tomb, and a couple of things really struck me. And that was one, if I'm right on this, some of the best craftsmen in England or even Europe were employed to create both the stone chest and to create the effigy. And also there's a huge amount of money spent. Can you give us an idea of the scale of that?
Yeah, only the best would do. So if you read the contracts for the making of the tomb and indeed other elements of the chapel, it's always the best, the finest, the best to be had in England and so on. And that applies not just to the materials, but to the workmen. So the glass, for example, which we'll talk a bit more later, is by the royal glazier, John Prudd. So they've gone absolute top. Yeah. The sculpture is a bit more uncertain. We know that the effigy was originally sculpted by a man called John Massingham. And of the craftsmen, he's the one that we know most about. But he's a carpenter by trade with cross skills in stone. And he worked at Canterbury Cathedral. He probably did the statues for Edward V's chantry at Westminster Abbey. Right. And prior to coming to Warwick, he was at All Souls, Oxford, doing some work there. So that, of course, the foundation of the Archbishop of Canterbury. So he's used to working for high-profile and demanding clients. And he's probably the man, definitely the man who carved the effigy from which it was cast, probably did the weepers that we've been talking about, probably did the statues around right. the east window.
Yeah.
So he's at the top of his game. Yeah. The other craftsmen, we know their names, but we have no other evidence of their work. This is all we have. But through that work, we can tell how skilled they are. And we touched on earlier the involvement of craftsmen from the Low Countries and inspiration from the Low Countries. And one of those is a man called Bartholomew Lambspring. Now, we know he'd settled in London by the time this tomb was made, but he was the engraver. And it's the engraving on the cast metal effigy that really sets it apart. Mm. So this is Richard Beauchamp's head that we're looking at now. And as you can see,
it is exquisite.
Every individual hair, has been reproduced on that. So the amount of time that took, the attention to detail, absolutely typical of this tomb. And it's not just the hair, we've got the feathers on the swan here.
And the veins on the side of his head is one of my favourites. It's incredible.
The feathers on the angels, on the griffin, all very, very carefully etched. Indeed, the angels are so detailed that you can see they've even got individual toenails and fingernails on them.
And look, you can see their hair is etched and the patterning on their headbands, everything is.
And I think it's this desire to get it as authentic as possible is a very distinguishing feature of this tomb.
Yes.
The armour is so accurate, we can identify who made the original. We know it came from Milan. There's a long story about that. But it again illustrates the fact that it's not any old armour. It's there for a specific reason.
Now, what about the cash?
The cash? Well, in stark terms, the tomb cost at least £720, which doesn't mean much.
Mm.
You know, what was £720
worth
in 1450? But if I was to say that when it was made, it was the most expensive tomb that had ever been made in England.
Wow.
Probably with one exception, which is Richard II's and Anne of Bohemia in Westminster Abbey, which has also got cast metal. And of course, it's a double tomb.
Yes.
So it's bigger and more expensive. So that tells you that we're out to impress here. Also, I think worth mentioning that the fact that there is a cast metal effigy is very, very significant, because as an earl, he wasn't supposed to have that. So there are 8 tombs in this country. Pre-Reformation, there's a couple later, Jacobean. There's 8 pre-Reformation tombs in this country that have cast metal effigies. There's 6 in Westminster Abbey.
Right.
There's 1 in Canterbury Cathedral.
Yeah,
and this is the 8th. And all the others are royal. Now, admittedly, there were some others that we've lost, but they were bishops.
Right, okay.
So cast metal is associated with bishops and with the royal family. It's not associated with earls. So the cost of that and the choice of material, and of course, we said earlier, covered in gold, immediately tells you that we are sending out a statement here.
Yeah.
And the quality as well. This is all about status and prestige.
Well, we said that this was one of the finest tombs, and I think I rest my case, my lord. Thank you so much for that. But before we leave the tomb, folks will know, if they follow me, how much I love tombs, and I get asked this question all the time. Is the body in the tomb chest, or is it in a vault? What do we know in this instance, Tim?
Normally it's a guess, unless you actually open it up and have a look, which we're not allowed to do anymore. The general consensus of opinion is that bodies are more often than not, let's hedge it a little bit, more often than not inside the chest. But here, in Richard's case, we know it very definitely isn't. And that is because where we're standing underneath the current floor is a staircase, set of stairs.
Mm.
Now, the west door, the main entrance to chapel, is behind us. Richard's tomb, of course, sits in front of the altar. And when Richard was buried in here, the body could be carried by bearers on their shoulders in a very dignified manner, walked down these steps and under the tomb, where there's a vault that is just under 2 metres deep.
How do we know that?
How do we know that?
Yes.
Because in 1720-something,
yes,
the floor collapsed.
Oh, really? Excellent.
And it's exposed the staircase.
Fantastic. I love those kind of serendipitous
and
moments.
And another side. But so that meant that what was in there was exposed, including Richard's coffin. So we know that his coffin was made of oak and elm. And the body was apparently quite intact, except that the women of Warwick, so it's recorded, then came into the chapel and took his hair as souvenirs and put it in lockets and so on.
This happens all the time. Honestly, I've written so many blogs about bits of royal bodies that have been pinched, including leg bones and all sorts of stuff. Yeah. It's incredible. Yeah.
Well, poor old Richard II has been messed around a lot, hasn't he? Lots of his bits of gold. But anyway. Well,
Edward IV in particular, they took all sorts of bits of him anyway.
But be as it may, I think there's only a record of them taking the hair. But that's how we know.
Right. OK, wonderful. Well, that must have been quite an event to watch.
Yeah.
No, we were talking about craftsmen, and one of the things we haven't yet talked about is so much is the architectural features of the chapel and what makes it so beautiful. So do you want to describe perhaps some of the most important or significant features of the chapel itself?
Well, I think there's two things to bear in mind, which we'll do very quickly, because I'm conscious of the fact we do need to bring the Dudleys back into the story at
yes,
this time.
We do.
But actually, just to reassure people who are listening to this, what we're saying is, believe it or not, all relevant to the Dudleys. So we'll just sort of throw that one out there now. But the quality of the workmanship, as we said, was of utmost importance. The glass that we're looking at now was the most expensive glass installed in England in the 15th century per square foot.
Right.
With one exception, which is a long-lost window at Eltham Palace, after Henry IV had refurbished it. And to give you an idea, the glass that we have here is 50% more expensive than Henry VI was going to pay for the glass at Eton College Chapel and at King's Cambridge.
Right.
So we were outspending the king by some margin, which again, we were saying earlier about the prestige of the effigy and so on. Again, look, we are throwing money at this for the sake of showing off.
The glory of the Beechams.
The glory of the Beechams. And where's that money gone? Well, two things, really. First of all, it's stained glass in the true sense, so that you would start with blue glass or red glass and then add your colours to it, rather than a white glass, a clear
right.
glass, and then
paint
putting
it.
On red paint or
right.
whatever.
I see.
And in England at the time, we didn't know how to make that, so it had to be imported. Again, Flanders and the Low Countries comes back into the story because that's where they made this. So that bumps the cost up. But what really blows the budget is a feature called jewelling. So all the windows have it to a certain extent, but around hems, borders, cloaks and so on, there are rows of what looked like and intended to look like pearls and then sapphires and rubies, precious jewels inserted between them. And the pearls, which are tiny, are all individual beads of glass, and they have drilled into the glass, created a sort of little crater and then put one of these glass beads into the hole and sealed it in. And every one of those is like that. So if we take St. Alban, who is in front of us here, there's probably, I don't know, 100 of these pearls around there, and they've all been individually done. And that's unique. I mean, I'm always hesitant to describe things as unique because there's always one example that somebody will throw at you, but I'm pretty confident on this one. It was extraordinarily expensive and difficult to do and time-consuming.
Yeah, of course.
So that is very much a distinguishing feature here.
And I could just point out and say, so most of the glass in that East End window is original. I know that some of the lights on the lower end have been obviously damaged at some point and reassembled. And then we have this range of windows on the south side, which is plain glass for a good two-thirds, and then it's really the top that survives.
Yeah.
But what we can see is largely original. Is that right?
Yes, original in the sense that you're never entirely sure without specialist investigation what's been patched and what's original. But yes, I think it's probably fair to say that it is original, or at least a faithful reproduction. But there's certainly a lot of original glass still in there.
Yeah.
As you say, the windows on the south and north below tracery, which are the little bits at the top, are all plain. That's because the chapel was smashed in the Civil War in 1643 by soldiers from the garrison at the castle. Mm. And the bottom register of the east window was as well. So the east window, although it's got original glass in, it's been patched from what survived in the side windows. Mm. But four lights have survived that are particularly important. And if you wanted four to survive, these are the four you'd want to keep, which are four saints, which is Becket, Alban, we've just mentioned, Winifred of Shrewsbury, and John of Bridlington.
All saints.
How on earth the image of Becket survived, I do not know.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's absolutely glorious. I mean, the colours are superb. The detail on his offerings are superb. He's got these pearls. There are details which you simply cannot see with the naked eye.
Yeah.
And he's shown in all his glory as an archbishop at the height of his powers, not as so often as a martyr or as a post-mortem vision. I mean, there he is. Now, we talked earlier about, I say, the importance and so on, and how the chapel distinguishes itself, perhaps, from the Westminster Abbey chapel, the Lady Chapel there. And we've talked about the narrative. We've already talked about the narrative of the journey of the body back to Warwick.
Mm.
But there are two other narratives overlaid on this, which would just, if I may explain very quickly, because it is actually relevant to the Dudley story. One is, this shows Richard's entry into heaven. So his hands are open. They're not in prayer.
Mm.
They're open. And if you're being cynical, it's because you say, well, he doesn't need prayer anymore because he's made it. He's there. And he's got God right at the top, just where the window joins the vault at the
top. Exactly what he's looking at.
He's looking at God. He's got the Virgin Mary in the vault above him. He's got saints and angels in statues in the window. All those statues, incidentally, are original. No Victorian reproductions here, thank you very much. Absolutely all original. They are definitely original. Absolutely, no question about those. He's got saints in the windows and the glass around him. He's got the heavenly choir. He's got the heavenly orchestra. And there is the greatest of English saints, Thomas Becket himself. And look where he's looking, and he's in the act of benediction.
Yes.
And he's looking directly at Richard. Coincidence? I think not.
Yeah.
And incidentally, Richard, you imagine, don't you, if you're entering the gates of heaven, you're either naked, and sometimes you see that in medieval art, your naked soul being carried up to heaven by angels, or you imagine you're some form of penitent in a very simple sort of sackcloth pleading with St. Peter to be allowed in, or St. Michael with his scales and judging whether you're there, pleading to be let in. You're humble, please. He's dressed in armour, full tournament armour, as if to say, when do I start? I'm here. We go. And then the third layer of narrative is affinity to the House of Lancaster. So we talked earlier about Richard's closeness to Henry V and Henry VI. And that affinity to the royal family is shown in many ways. I won't mention all of them, but a couple. The armour, so accurate, we know who made the original, made in Milan, almost certainly the same workshop that made the armour that Henry Bolingbroke wore at Gosford Green for the duel with Mowbray that never happened under Richard II. So a connection with the House of Lancaster even before they'd become members of the royal family. Nothing here is a coincidence. That armour, the fact it made for Milan, is significant. And then we go to the English saints, particularly Winifred and John of Bridlington. Bridlington in particular, very closely associated with Lancastrians. As far as I've been able to establish, Richard Beauchamp had no particular connection with John of Bridlington, other than through Lancastrians. Right. So there is a lot of Lancastrian imagery here, which is unfortunate, because this tomb is finished, the chapel is finished by about 1455. And of course, the First Battle of St. Albans, in what we now know as the War of the Roses, 1455, when Anne Beauchamp's husband, Warwick the Kingmaker, is on the Yorkist side.
Awkward.
What are we going to do? And in fact, the chapel was mothballed for 20 years.
I see, right, okay, interesting.
And I think there were other reasons for it. One was the inevitable argument over his inheritance. But that this affinity with Lancastrians must have been a problem. Mm. And ironically, it's a member of the House of York, George, Duke of Clarence, who becomes Earl of Warwick and actually arranges for the consecration. But he kind of swaps sides by then as well. So it all gets very messy.
Yes, it is very messy.
But that, so it's a hugely symbolic chapel of the utmost quality with very important narratives. And this, I think, is probably where we come onto the Dudleys.
It is because...
Time we did.
It is actually, because I am the Tudor Travel Guide and there has been very little Tudors so far. We keep dropping in the Dudleys here and there because, of course, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, there are three Dudley incumbents in this chapel. We've got Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester. We've got Ambrose Dudley. And we've got the noble imp, son of Robert Dudley. So... we're going to look at those tombs and talk a little bit about them because they're all interesting. But I think it's good to try and understand how they came to be in this chapel.
Well, I guess that's why we're here anyway.
I guess it probably is.
You have been listening to the first part of this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. The remainder of this episode is only available to members of my membership site, The Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England. To join the wait list to become a member of The Ultimate Guide, click on the link in the description associated with this podcast. You will be added to the waiting list and I will email you just as soon as the doors to the membership next reopen. I'll see you there. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling.